Welcome to my favorite podcast with Noah Marger.
Hey, I gotta say, I love him so much, but the SpongeBob really starts falling apart by the end of the phrase. It's just like, it sounds great at first, and all of a sudden, it's just, no, Marger. But yeah. I love him. I love that fucking guy.
I love him too. I hope he's doing well. Also, by the way, I don't know if you heard. Did you hear that? Did you hear about this?
I don't know what this is. I never heard about this kind of thing.
Are we doing this? Really?
Wait for it. I forgot about this part. Oh my god, the weird like montage of him like being like, I'm so incorrigible. What about like me as a host? What? Like
what? Has anyone ever thought of this? Me hosting a podcast?
It's like the podcast equivalent of him like posing with his arms folded and his like shoulder to the camera.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I know I'm being a bad boy, and I know you love it, bitch.
Exactly. Ugh. And we do, unfortunately.
Some of us do. Some of us can't stand it. Personally,
fair enough.
I'm just saying. Some of us shiver at the thought of having to listen to him talk to T-Bone Burnett about pickups for about 15-20 minutes on his interview. That's fine if you love that. I'm not saying you're wasting your time and your day.
No. You're judging the people. You're judging your audience.
I'm judging my audience. Yeah. Well. We all make judgments every single day, and it's important to keep the kind of the human race going. We are sharks in that way.
That's Magnolia. That's next week. You should save that.
Oh, I meant, hey, everybody, welcome back to my favorite podcast. This is a podcast about people's favorite things. I am the host of the show, whether you like it or not, Noah M. from school, Noah Marger. And with me for the next, I don't know how long at this point, but the next little while.
10 more weeks.
10 more weeks, he knows the exact amount of hours left in this entire situation because this is court ordered. Please welcome back for the second episode in the Paul Thomas Anderson series, Rocky Pajarito. Rocky.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm legally having a good time.
Legally, you are having a good time, and you do have to write that down specifically so that I can sign off on it at the end.
And I also need to get signatures from every single person who listens to the show from beginning to end. And we need at least 10. So if you're listening, buckle up.
Yeah, so we need to boost the listenership by about 10, tenfold. Rocky, how are you? Are you okay? Besides the fact that you're doing court-ordered community service right now?
I'm doing great. And I'm excited to talk about this movie. And it's also my anniversary with my girlfriend today. And the closer this day got, I'm like, it is really silly. I have this podcast scheduled, huh?
Wow, that sucks.
that kind of stinks shit on my end.
Yeah, it sucks shit, and it sucks shit for her. Like at the end of the day, she's gonna listen to this. She's gonna love this episode. She's gonna think, "Wow, those boys—they really spent a long time thinking about Paul Thomas Anderson and a long time thinking about Boogie Nights." I'm so glad they did this on my anniversary. That's what she's gonna think.
Absolutely. And also, for the record, we had an amazing time rewatching this movie together. Anyway, so it worked out. Although she does request from now on that she gets like a 30 minute slot on each episode where she gives her opinions.
That's fine. About just like politics and like what's going on in the world.
Yeah, not even about the movies exactly, just in general.
Yeah, well, we can maybe, my people will talk to her people.
Okay.
That's a funny industry thing to say, right? My people
it
will
is.
Talk to her
I remember
people.
When I was like a little kid, this would crack my parents and my family up. I would do an imitation of like a Hollywood like agent guy and I'd be like, let's do lunch. I'd say that shit.
Yes, let's do lunch, dude.
And also at one point I said I wanted to be a comedian, but I said I want to be a Canadian, and my family holds that over my head ever since.
And how are we doing on that? How is being a Canadian?
I have the paperwork coming in. I'm excited. I've been watching Degrassi. I'm like 7 seasons in now.
Damn, you really are about to be a Canadian for real.
For real, for real. Did you know Kevin Smith's in Degrassi?
The Red State's own Kevin Smith?
Yeah, Red State's, yeah, Tusk's own Kevin Smith.
Jay and Silent Bob Reboot's own Kevin Smith?
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about this later. I think you'd like this.
Yeah, let's not talk about it right now. Let's not fuck around and talk about Kevin
I'm
Smith
trying to be a good Degrassi. Co-host, you know?
No, dude, you are being a good co-host. Stop that right
Thanks,
now.
Thanks, bro. Thank you, bro.
I do actually, I am, this is something I actually have written down to tell you, though, for real. And I think I messaged you this, and I'm like, I have something so crazy to tell you, but I have to tell you on air.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I was looking forward to this, actually. So,
oh, yeah, now that you reminded me and it didn't leave your brain at all, now you're excited to hear about it.
Yep.
Okay. So, by the time this comes out, this will have been last Friday. But as we're recording it, it was this past Friday, which I guess is still last Friday for the people listening. But... the New Beverly Cinema. We're familiar with the New Beverly Cinema?
I've heard of this New Bev.
I've seen it on Tumblr. So I heard about it on Tumblr. And I went for the first time. No, just
congratulations.
I go there all the time. It's just a joke. And because I'm currently looking for the next gig. I had a little time on Friday afternoon to go see their Friday matinee of Wayne's World.
Hell yeah.
Which I had not seen in over 10 years. I had not seen that probably since like sixth grade or fifth grade even. So
really? Wow.
This has been a long time coming for me to rewatch this movie. I remember liking it at the time, but to be honest with you, it's even better than I remembered, and it's even better with a crowd.
That's right. Oh, I bet. I have not seen Wayne's World with a crowd, but I can only imagine that it plays even better. There's some funny stuff in there. It's Mike so Myers, good. Man. You forget how truly good Mike Myers is because of how much of a joke his stuff has become.
Yeah.
But, like, honestly, he's so funny. Dana Carvey, also a fucking genius.
Oh, yeah. The fact that Dana Carvey is kind of playing the sidekick role to Mike Myers is pretty amazing because Dana Carvey is, like, legendary, like, on his own.
He can do any kind of big, boisterous leading role character, but Garth is such a special example of downplaying as humor that I feel like I can't even think about other characters in comedy history that are as successful or memorable for being such a, like, meek individual. You know, there's plenty. Millions. They've made so many movies over the years. I mean, do you know how many movies they've made over the past 2 years?
Over the past 2 years, I'm not sure, but if you go to Letterboxd, which I'm doing right now, and
what's
then you
that?
Click
I don't
films,
know what that is.
Shut the fuck up. If you go to Letterboxd and you go films, and then you just go to most popular all time, it says according to Letterboxd. There are 739,157 films.
What?
And that, brother, that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning of them.
I can't believe I've seen three.
You've seen three? Yes.
I've seen three movies.
Yeah, and they're all and that's all the movies that we've talked about on this podcast together.
Exactly.
That's so awesome. Here's the actual reason why I wanted to tell you about this. I'm not just bragging that I saw Wayne's World in the theater.
Well, I was glad to talk about Wayne's World, but also what else happened that evening?
What else happened, brother? Well, let me tell you. So as you know, or maybe our listeners know, the New Beverly has a very strict, basically once the lights go down, shut the fuck up and watch the movie policy, you know?
Right.
They're like, if you are talking, if you're looking at your phone, we'll ban you from this space, basically. And they do it.
Tarantino
kind of
himself will pull you out of your chair and drag you out of the theater.
He'll pluck you out of the chair and he'll say, listen, I think you're a great guy. You can't be doing that in the movies. You can't be doing that.
I like that he clarifies, though. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, it's really cool and nice that he thinks that you're cool because he probably would talk during his movies, too. That's just an assumption that I have about him. Unfounded completely. But
Right.
But the lights go down. The movies, the like pre-show starts. And I'm sitting on the end of the row, and there's, like, five or six chairs. Like, you know, it's not a full theater, so there's, like, five or six chairs to the left of me that are open. And a very wiry man comes by, on my row, and goes, excuse me, sorry, and then sits down about two or three chairs from me. And I swear to God, I thought to myself, I think I know who that is. And I very slightly looked to the left. It was Paul Rust.
Ah, oh,
Paul Rust was sitting three chairs away from me watching Wayne's World with me in the theater. If he ever hears this, you were not watching it with me, Paul. You were watching it on your own. I don't think that we were hanging out.
all of a sudden, it's a best friend date with my pal, Paul.
With my best friend in the whole world, Paul Rust, who I met for the first time. So I'm obviously starstruck by this. Like, he's one of the funniest people in the world, one of the funniest guys on the planet. But I'm not going to lean over to him because I go to the New Bev a lot and I don't want to fuck my shit up, you know, and he's enjoying the movie. Yeah. So I'm like, I just got to wait till the minute the light goes up. I'm going to say something quick and then I'm going to run away as fast as I can from the theater.
Good strat.
But as you may know, the Wayne's World credits are long because there's two credit scenes, basically, like two little moments during the credits. And Paul obviously is a cinephile, so he knows, stick around for the credits of Wayne's World, you know? Yeah. So we're just sitting there, and I'm just fucking biting my tongue the entire time, like, okay, are you going to do it? Are you going to say anything? Like, what's going to happen? And the minute the light went up, I just turned in my seat, quickly said, excuse me, I really don't want to ruin your day at all. And then I just said, you're just one of the funniest guys in the world. I love, you know, everything that you've been a part of. I go and see Playhouse Masterpieces with my friends at the Elysian all the time. Like, you just give me a lot of laughs over the years. And Rocky, he was so nice. He was so fucking nice.
Yes.
He shook my hand. He asked me what my name was. It was so cool.
I'm so happy. Wow.
It was great.
Okay. Whoo. That's really nice. And also just lines up with how he seems as a person.
I know.
That's amazing.
I literally said to him at one point, and I don't know if he, I think he liked it. I don't know if he actually liked it or not, but I said to him, I kind of feel like Wayne and Garth right now, and you're kind of like Alice Cooper. Because that moment in the movie where they go and meet Alice Cooper, and they go, we're not worthy. Yeah.
That's cute.
So it was really a nice moment. He said, oh, this made my day. Thank you so much. So super nice in that moment. Seems to be a really lovely man and obviously one of the funniest guys that we got. So,
Noah, I just got this Deadline article sent to me. It says, my favorite Paul cast renewed for season 2 for Paul Rust's acting career. We're going to have to do.
They're bringing CISO back for this.
They're bringing CISO back for my favorite Paul cast.
Goddamn, goddamn.
So we'll talk about I Love You, Beth Cooper, Inglourious Basterds. That's it.
Is he in that?
Are you serious?
I haven't seen Inglourious Basterds in so long.
He is one of the bastards.
Yo, I literally don't remember like hardly anything from Inglourious.
The casting of the bastards is pretty crazy because
is BJ Novak one of the bastards?
BJ Novak is one of them. He's one of the more crucial ones near the end. But Paul Rust is in it. Michael Bacall, who co-wrote 21 Jump Street and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, is one of the bastards. Sam Levine from Freaks and Geeks is one of the bastards. Yeah, it's very weird.
They went crazy.
Good like Jewish comedy stunt casting in like late 2000s like style. It's really good.
Damn, Rocky.
Huh?
I'm gonna let my nuts hang real quick because we got to talk about the movie.
They're so salty.
Ooh, kiss those nuts. We got to talk about the movie, Rocky. That's why I said I gotta let my nuts hang, because this movie is pornographic, to say the least.
You could say that again, friend.
Yup. Let me play the sound. Yup. This movie is pornographic. So if you're under 18 listening to this, P.U., you stink. Get out of here. That's what I say to that. But, folks, today we are talking about the movie that probably most people were introduced to by PTA, especially at the time that this came out. This is his second feature film. This is 1997's Boogie Nights. Snap, snap, snap. Clap, clap, clap. Rocky, same three questions as last time. What was going on in your life when this movie came out? How old were you? What was life like for you in 1997?
1997. I'm about 3 years old, I think.
I'm about three fucking years old, if you could fucking believe it.
So I am like, what, in like kindergarten or preschool? Probably preschool at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm eating crackers and reading big books that are made of like big thick paper about elephants learning letters and shit like that.
Yep.
And yeah, you know, it's a beautiful time. Vincent Gallo is probably making Buffalo 66 somewhere on the other side of the country, and the world is good. The Big Lebowski is probably being edited at this point. The world is good.
Rushmore is probably being finished up.
True. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. He's Wes Anderson's probably having a conversation with Owen Wilson that's a little uncomfortable about how Wes should write a majority of the Royal Tenenbaums, but Owen Wilson gives him the idea, and all is right in the world.
What else is Clinton is president?
Yeah.
There's some talks about some stains on some dresses, probably around that time. I don't know.
Here's a crazy question: when did Princess Di die?
I think, that's a good question. I actually bet you it's this year.
Folks, Princess Diana died in 1997, August 31st.
A few months before this came out.
Damn. That is the William H. Macy blowing his brains out of world society in this, you know what I'm saying? That's kind of like the turning point. It's a turning point. When Princess Diana died, well, I guess that'd also be 9/11. Noah, what's going on with you in 1997?
Oh, Rocky, thank you so much for asking, my friend. When this movie comes out in October of 1997. I am but 10 months old. Finally, swam my way out of my dad's balls.
Good for you.
Blasted into my mom's whatever goes
Jesus
on down
Christ.
There.
Jesus was, Christ.
They gave birth to me on January 5th, 1997 at Metro Hospital in Cleveland, I think.
Wow.
Cleveland, Ohio. We were living in Strongsville, Ohio at the time, which is a suburb. Don't really remember much of Strongsville. I have very, very, very faint memories of what I thought maybe like our like foyer or like our entryway to our house or wherever we were living at the time.
I love that shit.
But I couldn't ever tell you if it was for real or not. Definitely shitting my pants at this time, watching Sesame Street. So basically the same shit I'm doing now, more
for
or
real.
Less.
For real. You said this came out in October, and it did make me look at the thing, because I was born in October. And this came out on Halloween, which is pretty crazy. And I'm pretty sure, because the year previous, Space Jam came out, and I was obsessed with it. I am pretty sure that when Boogie Nights came out in theaters, I was wandering around the shopping center near my home in Anaheim Hills, dressed in a Michael Jordan Bulls jersey, trick-or-treating. I'm pretty sure that's what was happening literally as Boogie Nights came out.
Did you have, I mean, I don't know if you can be that young and have a sexual awakening, but were you at all attracted to Lola Bunny in that moment, in the time?
I had a sexual awakening, but it was with Wayne Knight.
Let's go. Let's fucking go. We have the Bill Murray cameo got you excited as fuck.
Absolutely.
In Space Jam.
That's true. Cool. It's true. Yep.
Did you get candy, get some good candy that year? Do we remember?
Oh, I think so. I'm pretty sure I got some good candy. Yeah.
Nice. Rocky, how old were you? What was going on in your life? When did you first watch Boogie Nights?
God, Boogie Nights is probably the... In what order did I actually... Yeah, this is kind of one of the last PTA movies that I saw for the first time. I had already seen Punch Drunk Love and Magnolia and loved it. The Master came out. It must have been before The Master. But I was like getting obsessed with Punch Drunk Love and Magnolia. And I also think I saw Heart 8 before it even, funny enough.
Oh, shit.
But I have a very distinct memory of walking around in my my bedroom and seeing that it was on like HBO or Cinemax or something. And it was the scene where the first filming scene where they're in the soundstage and it's very like matter of fact, first AD going around and stuff. And I was just fucking enamored. I was like, I kind of can't believe that this is what this movie is. Like, I knew it was about porn and sex and stuff. And it was kind of like a movie that you'd see clips of on YouTube, like craziest moments in it and whatnot. Right. But watching that scene, it did make me kind of like, try like seek it out. I think I went to like the like Blockbuster before it died, basically, and like just try to get a copy and just like I need to watch this one now. But yeah, it is one of the later PTA movies that I watched. I guess before like even in like it was right before Inherent Vice came out. I think when I saw this, maybe.
How so? You would have been like 18.
Yeah, 18 going on 19, maybe 20 okay. or something like that. Maybe 23. I might have been 32 years old when I saw this movie.
You might have been just hanging it up, retiring at that point.
For real, for real. But yeah, I was already obsessed with Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love when I was finally seeing Boogie Nights, basically.
That's so interesting because I feel like I said, like kind of up top, I feel like this is a lot of people's entryway to PTA, even if they don't know they're watching a PTA movie. This is probably his most
Definitely.
Popular mainstream film, if I could say.
It's like right up there with There Will Be Blood, because There Will Be Blood had such a fucking meme cachet right upon, you know, exiting the womb, basically, like with all the I drink your milkshake and kind of made Daniel Day-Lewis like a household term for like the world's greatest actor kind of, you know.
Yeah. And thoughts my dad or whatever. Said, my dad said, I don't give a fuck about that guy. Stop talking about that guy.
Damn, bro.
Really fucked up of him.
Yeah. But I agree with you. I think in hindsight, even, yeah, this is like, we were like, obviously we were super young at this point when it came out, but in listening to people talk about when Boogie Nights came out, like I kind of mentioned him in the first episode, Jeff Gerstmann of Giant Bomb, talked about working at a movie theater when Boogie Nights came out, and him and his friends and other employees would always go back into the theater just kind of like, you know, when it's running already for another screening, and they'd watch for the William H. Macy scene or for when he pulls his penis out stuff. Like, it's just such a audacious, crazy movie to come out that, like, it just seems exciting. Like, I kind of wish that I was, you know, a young cinephile already when this movie came out, because it is so big and crazy and lovable and loving. But yeah, I was like late to the party. And in hindsight, when you think about the greatest movies of the 90s, Boogie Nights is like right up there, even more so than Magnolia, I think. Because when Absolutely. I saw Magnolia, I knew more about Boogie Nights than I did Magnolia. Like, Magnolia was kind of like a weird hidden movie behind Boogie Nights. I just never really had the like foresight or directed interest to watch Boogie Nights just yet. Magnolia, when I learned about it, I was like, that sounds specifically crazy. And yes. I watched that first instead, I think.
I actually had a similar trajectory to you, but I'm going to save that for next week when we actually talk about Magnolia for real.
Sounds
but
good.
In terms of when I first watched this, I can't be for certain it was high school. I know for a fact it was in high school. Probably got it from DVD Netflix, most likely, right. because we had
yes,
that
of course.
For, I think, most of, if not all of me being in high school. So I was either sophomore or junior. I'm going to guess I was a junior, probably. So I was probably 16 or 17 when I watched this movie for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I think, obviously, when you watch it for the first time, and especially when you're 16 or 17, you're, you know, a younger person, it is pretty, like, you're watching some pretty gnarly stuff on screen, both in a sexual capacity, but also in kind of a violence capacity, because
yes.
there is some pretty heavy violent things, whether they're actually bloody or like physically assaulting in one way or another. There's some just violent behavior, whether it's the cocaine use in the movie, just the very, I guess for lack of a better term, free-spirited lovingness of the whole thing. Like, there's just a lot of violent stuff going on in this movie. Even at the beginning, the way the fucking, basically the reason that gets Mark Wahlberg's character out of the house, that is a horrifying scene.
It's emotional violence, 100%. Yes. Yeah, this movie presents a full rainbow spectrum of intimacy, you know, literally, physically, and also emotionality. And it reaches, it's at its most extreme, kind of this like cosmic desire for being needed and wanted in a group.
Yes.
And by other people in general. Like, I was going to say, there's not really a lot of, like, direct romance in this movie, but it is a romantic film. Like,
yeah,
it's very romantic.
It's romantic about the, like, the group, the love of a group and being in a community.
Yeah, exactly. The community, the commune, as the house. Like, everything that happens in that house, basically. In West Covina. Shouts out, West Covina. Yeah, that scene at the beginning with Mark Wahlberg's mom, Joanna Gleason. Yes. I was actually doing a hangout stream on Everything Now recently. And Joanna Gleason rated us with three viewers.
That was so nice of her, by the way.
She was just playing Stardew Valley. Grant.
She was just getting started. She didn't really know how it works.
She's like, I don't know what this is. I got to go into caves now. Grant Crater, friend of this friend of you and of Everything Now fame.
Friend of Everything Now. He's on the show. I'm friends with the guy.
No, he's a member of Everything Now, but friend
he's
of
a member
Noah.
Of Everything Now. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm fucking saying.
No, but no. Okay. Yeah, he comes in with a link to an interview that Joanna Gleason does about that scene. And she was very into playing this character as written and like to the specificity of PTA. And then says something to the degree of like, if this is how your mom actually was in real life, like, I'm glad that you left. And I'm also like, you know, I will do this as explicitly as you need it to be. And boy, you watch that scene where she's tearing down his posters.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. And I think it's only as wonderful as Mark Wahlberg actually breaking down crying is.
Yeah.
Like, Sorry, go
ahead. And no. I was just going to say in 1997.
Yes.
To cast Mark Wahlberg basically as the lead of your film.
Yeah.
Is so ballsy.
It's kind of suicide.
It is crazy. He was most well known for being a white rapper previous to this. That's crazy of PTA, and it works so well. I cannot imagine anybody else being Eddie Adams.
I think it might be a friend of the show, Kevin Cookman's review. I might be completely misattributing that. But he points out that everyone in this cast essentially is like not, you know, of huge relevancy to the grander world. Like, it's a lot of this like cavalcade of character actors and Burt Reynolds, who's kind of in the twilight or like the post twilight of his career or whatever.
Sure. Yes.
Like, it literally is just a bunch of people who love making movies, but aren't necessarily like the biggest stars in the world or whatever, which I think makes this even better. I think it gives it so much more vibrancy and personality and life in its veins. And if they got fucking like Leonardo DiCaprio to play.
Right. Which was the original want.
Totally.
Him.
It would have been like imagine the version of like Leonardo DiCaprio and Warren Beatty, you know, which again could be great. I don't see that not being bad.
Yeah,
being
that's probably going to be really cool no matter what. But if for whatever reason, the alchemy at play, the chemistry between everyone in this movie, both in their individual parts and how they interact with each other. Like, to me, Burt Reynolds and Julianne Moore as sort of the patriarch and matriarch of this entire thing.
Sure.
It seems like it was like, oh yeah, that was destined to be that because they just seem so perfect for those characters. And every time I watch this movie, Julianne Moore's whole thing hits me harder and harder and harder. Basically to the point where the first time I watched, I didn't even really recognize what was going on with her.
Right.
To now I'm like, I can't believe this isn't a bigger aspect of the movie. This is so sad and so like heartwarming how it kind of comes together.
Yeah, the culmination for a lot of this stuff is very, it shows a lot of grace, which I think is beautiful and I think almost outlandish to a certain degree that like he so willingly gives everyone, for the most part, a very happy ending. Everyone kind of like deserves it to a certain degree.
I was just
about
to, some people don't, and that's okay.
That character, yeah, exactly. I was going to say, we can talk about that plot later on or whatever. But like, yeah, this movie shows you how far rock bottom is and borders on being cruel in kind of like a Todd Solondz kind of way. Like, there's a lot of these characters like really suffer and really are just get like a boot in the face, like for this, like in the third act of this movie. And I love the way that he structures, PTA structures the journeys for like nine characters or whatever, you know, and they all kind of go through similar thematic beats at the same time. And you kind of like get to interweave yourself through four different plots, not in the same kind of like breakneck speed of Magnolia or something, but in this kind of more graceful, similar orchestration, I guess, of like, you know, you got like, I think my favorite part version of this is when things are at actual rock bottom, where Dirk Diggler is in the parking lot getting beat up and Roller Girl and Jack are in the limo with that douchebag from Roller Girls High School.
That scene is so brutal.
Yeah. And then you have Don Cheadle going to the donut store. Like it's such a good confluence of all the characters going through a similar spiritual crisis at the same time.
He here is actually, I think, doing Altman more than he's actually doing Altman in Magnolia, which was not my opinion prior to this watch. I was like, oh, Magnolia is Shortcuts,
it's
but on coke,
movie,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But this is more Altman, I think, than Magnolia, actually,
definitely.
At the end of the day.
Yeah, the way, like, oh my god, the opening scene, how it just gracefully sets up, like, a majority of the main characters and, like, what they're about and what they're going to go through in such graceful, loose...
You don't even notice it. You don't even think about it.
Not at all, yeah. But, like, when you do clue into it, you're like, oh my god, this screenplay is so dense and alive and so detailed. Like, when you really do pay attention to the details that go into this film, it is... I don't know. It's like, you know, you can probably weasel your way into being the young prince of Hollywood, you know, and be a terrible filmmaker. But it does help that PTA seems to have surrounded himself with amazing artists to create such full, wonderful stories like this one with all that access that he gets. Like, it's crazy how beautiful this movie is to me.
How many times do you think you've seen this movie?
Less than 10. This is probably like my fifth or sixth time, maybe.
That's where I'm at with it too. It's one of the ones I've seen more. This is like one on the upper echelon of movies I've rewatched of his. It is also the first time that we're in the San Fernando Valley, which is more or less his favorite place to place a movie.
Yep, his sandbox, his playground. I mean, this thing is like even more personal because like he makes before making Hard Eight. A short film version of this movie, the Dirk Diggler story. It's kind of like a mockumentary or whatever. So this Boogie Nights has kind of been in his head ever since, like, it seems like the beginning, basically.
Yes.
And I think that's what makes it so personal. But anyway, what's you want to wrap it up?
Yeah. No, I think that's enough.
I think we're good.
I think yes, they shoot porn in the movie. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are adult film actors and adult film crew members, and they work in that world. But this movie is really about finding your family and finding your people. Like, really, at the end of the day.
Every PTA movie boils down to that.
It really does. And you see it in this so lovingly and so warm. And again, I'm going to say it basically every episode, but it is so amazing to me, and basically the reason why his movies resonate so hard, at least on a personal level for me, is that no matter what is going on, he seems to find a way to let the light in and really let the warmth just bake into your blood. It is such a loving, warm film. And that scene, it's the second to last scene of the film.
Yeah,
and it really hit me hard this time. Mm-hmm. It's just following Jack Horner around the house, and we get to check in with a majority of the main characters.
Yeah.
And there's something so peaceful and lovely about this, like, we're just relaxing, we're just having fun. This is family, you know, whether we're related by blood or not, this is family. It's one of my favorite parts of the whole movie now, to be honest with you, just that little sequence.
I agree. And it does this thing that I think like Wes Anderson movies do and even some Scorsese movies, but like the ensemble wrap up where like you kind of have like a one-er maybe, and you're just basically saying goodbye to all the characters and you're seeing them in their states of transcendence while also being their same selves and stuff. I'm getting emotional thinking about this scene also. I mean, but yeah, it is so beautiful and also funny because, you know, the stereo is still working weird, and like everyone is just
Buck
being
trying to set up the stereos.
My God, my God, he might be my MVP on it. We're gonna come back to that. But also, I was just gonna say, I mean, like, he got God only knows,
like,
of course he's gonna be making these like emotional catharsis bombs, you know, like,
he kind of
intrinsically understood that from the beginning. To use one of the best pop songs ever written, one of the most heartwarming, lovely songs in the world, to kind of like to close your movie out and to say goodbye to all your loving characters, except for one guy maybe.
except for one guy maybe for sure.
And then it like devolves into one of the best pieces of score that PTA has ever gotten in his movies, which is this like circus, circus theme that he uses at the beginning of the movie as an overture. And then uses it to close the film out as well. It is melancholic and kind of funny, but mostly sad and loving. And he like directs that entire ending sequence with so much heart. It's kind of unbelievable that like even just a little bit of change in control after Hard Eight, you see how much he's capable of when he is kind of like at the helm or whatever, yes. You know, whether that is, you know, relinquishing to collaborators or, you know, like sharing the reins or whatever, or if that's his mastermind control, pinpoint precision or whatever. Either way, it's like, wow, you as a ringleader pulled together something so beautiful while also being hysterical and insanely fucked up in some parts. This thing is funny. This is a funny fucking movie. This movie
is so fucking funny.
I feel like this probably is the case. This is probably played at like on Comedy Central before in like censored forms or something like that.
Sure.
And in watching it, I'm like, of course it does. This is a comedy. This is a very funny comedy that, like all good comedies, like most good comedies, has its dramatic points because it's telling a good story as well. But in the end, wraps itself up as a Shakespearean style in the structural sense, a comedy. That ends with like everyone kind of together and holding hands. It's a wedding, as most comedies are in that kind of spiritual sense. It's a wedding of these souls all being like, we are going to gladly be a family together. But it's also just a hilarious movie.
Three things. Number one, making Buck Swope a stereo salesman is such a good decision. Like, how God do you damn, think, yeah. I mean, in the present day, that's a very, very niche position to have. Obviously in the 70s, it's a little bit more ubiquitous.
Sure.
But just the decision to make him a stereo salesman is so cool. Yeah. That is so smart and cool because you just get to let Don Cheadle cook basically every moment that he's on screen. And he is such an electrifying presence in this 100%. Movie and in every movie that he's in.
Yeah.
So that's that. Yeah.
Go ahead. Go through all the three points.
The other thing, I actually forgot the third one, to be completely honest with you. But the second one, then the real. And the second one that I really did want to say is I wanted to touch on that circus theme. Because that, and I've written this on letterboxd.com before, but it definitely bears repeating.
What is that? Okay, go ahead.
That circus theme tells you the whole fucking story of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Even before anything is shown to you. You're just hearing it. It is the perfect table setter. And if you've seen the movie before and you're going back, it basically tells you the entire story from, you know, tip to taint, to use a term. You know, like it really does kind of give you the whole picture. And I think that is so brilliant. And so it actually does kind of make me sad. I love John Bryan. I love Johnny Greenwood. It does kind of make me sad that Michael Penn didn't stay in the rotation.
Sure. Of composers. Yeah, that's true. I mean, there clearly was so much to offer and glean from it. Also, you have that sound cue and a full score cue from Hard Eight in this movie. I believe it's like Clementine's theme or something like that. And they use it in equally horrifying effect here in this film. And
yeah, it's almost like the Jaws theme almost is kind of what that gives off the same vibe.
Exactly. But it's like in a similar way, like, or I guess like, you know, maybe in the yin to yang or whatever. Instead of it being like, where is the shark? It's like you are inside the shark. Like the shark is actively eating you and darkness is taking over everybody's life. It is beautiful. And also, I got to say, I really fucked up last year not bringing my girlfriend to a 35mm screening of this movie. Because for Valentine's Day, because it's just one of those things where you're so much time in between seeing this movie again. Like it's probably been like a couple of years since I'd seen Boogie Nights at that point. And I'm like, yeah, it's a good movie and I really like it. But in my head, I didn't think of it as romantic because, you know, in hindsight, it's not a one-to-one romantic film. It's something much bigger, more cosmic. But in watching this time, I think we have a projector in our room. The lights were down. It's like really nice, you know, like I've created a little nice home theater for us. But that opening with the overture over Black is so beautiful and wonderful. And then I think this is like except for like Licorice Pizza. This is a movie where PTA starts by grabbing you by the shoulders and screaming in your face. And like the fucking. Like music cue, like right off the bat with the logo,
the transition from overture of like, what is this?
Yeah.
Like, what are we about to get ourselves into one of the most like bombastic songs ever recorded? Best of My Love by The Emotions. Perfect. Yes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, truly unbelievable. And yeah, it is a testament again to all of the music in this movie. It's like, wow, this is also one of the best pop songs ever made, isn't it?
Yes.
And they're all used perfectly. Sometimes the songs narrate the film, like the scene where at a party at Jack's house, Amber Waves misses a call from her son. And Luis Guzman is unable to like discern the discrepancy in her name from her legal name.
Yes,
and then
Lonely Boy. It's Lonely Boy.
Yeah. It literally cuts to her as Lonely Boy plays the chorus. And I like, it's just another moment in this movie where I kind of couldn't believe what I was seeing.
I didn't realize, like, this is the first time watching the movie where that fully clicked for me. I swear to God, I wrote that down too, Rocky. I was blown away by that moment.
Yeah, really, really. Like, we have a category in the show that is best musical moment. And it just, like, after this movie was done, I was like, the entire movie is, like, just one amazing moment after another playing with music. It's so special. This is such a, like, back to Buck Swope being a stereo salesman also. And what he has to do on his job is trying to sell entertainment and trying to sell, like, that kind of transcendent experience that all the characters are trying to sell, you know? Like, they're entertainers. They're artists in their own way, you know? Not even in their own way. They're sincerely artists. And it's, God, I don't know. It's so great. I think it's great that PTA kind of left it all in the field regarding making movies with this one. I mean, he goes back to it a little bit with Licorice Pizza. But, like, I think there's something about this movie, like, that is like a thesis essay about his feelings about filmmaking and about entertainment and about catharsis you can reach through it. And he like kind of left it all in this one beautiful, big glowing ball before he goes on to tell different stories about different kinds of people.
I wanted to talk about specifically Jack Horner for a second.
Sure. Oh my God. Yeah.
Because this is I couldn't tell you the last time I watched this movie, probably in lockdown is what I would guess is probably the last time I watched this. But the Jack Horner does not think of himself as an adult filmmaker in this movie. No. He just thinks of himself as a filmmaker in this movie. And that's kind of insanely beautiful to me that he, although he is the purpose of these movies is to make you come, which this movie does make me come. That's why three different times during the 2.5 hours of this movie.
For sure.
The way he talks about what these movies can be, they can be more than just jacking off and leaving, is so inspiring. That scene in the diner. You remember that scene specifically that I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of like, of many crucial moments in this movie, it is like the special moment where he like tells his dream or whatever. And it's so good. And, you know, Dirk Diggler kind of says this in one of his acceptance speeches where he's like, our movies help people. They help men. They help relationships and stuff. And also this is at a time, which I think this movie does very gracefully. And PTA is really good at this actually, where he portrays content based on period without hammering it over, like just kind of like letting it become the background. Like the context of the 70s and stuff like that, or whatever part of history that he's portraying at that point, it all just kind of becomes like this like living wallpaper a little bit, whether it's like people reading reviews or like showing people normal people going to porn theaters, because that's normal. That's like in the 70s, like that was an active thing and it was kind of a communal experience. And perhaps the fact that we were much more in tune with that kind of thing in a little more comfortable sense, maybe there was a little more joy in the world because people were like open about their sexuality and stuff. Like, I don't know. It's like, this movie's so romantic about that notion. Also, there's so much respect for pornography that it's like really not a joke throughout.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, heat check performer of the fucking millennium. Bro.
I can't believe it, dude. I can't believe it.
Scotty J, funniest guy of all time, dude.
So, so lovable. And like, again, that's a character that could be played as just a creepy joke or whatever. But this time around, I watch him and I'm like so happy that he's around. And like no one judges him really. He's like an awkward guy. But he's not judged for being gay or for being like a kind of clumsy romantic or whatever.
Until
everyone's, you know, too on drugs. And then that night culminates in terrible things anyway. But like literally his presence is just it made me smile so much. Like he is, you know, I'm sure in many eyes he kind of plays it as like, I don't think Philip Seymour Hoffman plays Scotty J as creepy, at least not on purpose. No. You know, he plays him. No. It's the 70s. He's like he plays a guy who's just kind of like, you know, just trying to be himself, and he's awkward, and he's
I've
sincere.
Never thought of Scotty J as creepy. I've only thought of him as awkward, I guess, at most. You know?
Absolutely.
Like, this is a man who has desires and feelings and fears, just like every other character in this movie.
Absolutely.
He's just extremely shy.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
And also, I mean, you kind of discover the movie's heart through him because of the way he reacts to things. Like, he's like a child, kind of. He doesn't, like, break right. down crying, really. But he does, like, physically wince and revulse and like, hold yeah. himself when things are going bad. And
that scene where Dirk freaks out at Jack, yeah. Scotty's in the background, basically just horrified at the entire thing.
Totally.
And I was looking at him, and I'm like, oh, this is the audience right now.
Yeah,
this
totally.
This is what we're
inside.
Thinking too.
Absolutely inside. It's true. Also, I mean, one of the funniest lines in PTA's career: we can't film in the state that you're in. The state that I'm in. I'm in California, Jack. I know what state I'm in. Like, that's
it's really fucked up.
It's a really yeah. That's another line where I'm like, the line is funny, but also like, oh god, Dirk is pathetic. Like,
yeah,
this movie,
he's an asshole.
This movie starts with the worst and meanest woman in the world saying, "You're a fucking idiot, and you won't be able to do anything." And he's like, "I'm not an idiot." And then the movie goes on, and you're like, "Oh no, he's kind of an idiot."
He's kind of an idiot, but in that world, he's actually like, it's fine. I
yeah,
guess you know
totally.
What I mean. Like, it's fine, and that's the beautiful thing about it is that regardless of what. No matter what happens outside the house,
yeah.
when you come in the house, that doesn't matter. You're family. We got you.
Absolutely. And he kind of like, it reminds me of Showgirls, where he's like talking about his like Italian leather shoes or like his karate room and shit like that, where he's like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, but he's like so proud. He's like a little boy. He's like a little yes. boy showing off his toys. And he's been such a good boy to the people in his family that it's like, yeah, we're all happy. It's fine. Let him be like his little doofy little child self, kind of.
The first scene where he and Reed meet each other and they're Ooh. Going kind of mano a mano and they're talking about how much
John
they can bench.
C. fucking Riley in this movie.
Unbelievably. I mean, obviously John C. Riley was kind of, you know, our main guy, him and Phil Baker Hall last. We haven't even talked about Phil Baker Hall in this
I
movie
know.
Yet either.
I know.
Damn, the kids keep fucking coming. This is one of the best casts ever assembled.
Yes, fully 1,000% agreed. Yeah.
It's insane, the star power in this movie. Yeah. But that scene where he's making him a drink, and mm-hmm. he's basically more or less trying to size him up and be like, oh, is this guy going to be competition for me?
Yeah.
He's doing it in such a California way.
Yeah.
He's doing
oh,
it in
for
such,
sure. Yeah.
Such a SoCal, such a like, yeah, dude, you're my friend, but if you say the wrong thing right now, I'm going to fucking crush you and you're not going to be my friend type
exactly.
thing. Exactly. Awesome.
He's balled up every single audition room experience that he's had at this point, and he's just made it into one dude. And my favorite thing about Reed Rothschild is how quickly and immediately, with no struggle, he becomes the hype man for Dirk Diggler. Like, that first scene is so funny because of how, like, yeah, how much you bench press? I bench press a little bit more. You seen Star Wars? They say I'm like Han Solo or whatever.
Yes.
But as soon
yeah,
as he
I
sees
love
that. One scene with Dirk Diggler doing his thing, he immediately is like, I'm your second-hand man. I think you're the best.
I think you're
amazing.
You're the fucking shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he literally, as Amber Waves and Dirk finish their first sex scene, you hear John C. Reilly being like, doesn't he fuck hard? Doesn't he fuck good?
I didn't think I heard that at this time around. That's so funny.
I mean,
funny.
You know, it's the Altman thing. This movie's very much an Altman thing, I think. And it's great how he peppers in all these little characters saying really funny and sweet shit.
Another really, really stupid funny thing that I like fully appreciated this time around mm-hmm. is Reed's poem in the hot tub when he's talking about sliding down the tree. That is so stupid and so funny. And like, you know he wrote that.
For sure.
You know that that is a Reed Rothschild original poem.
It's so awesome how much this John C. Reilly is one-to-one with the Adam McKay John C. Reilly.
Like, yeah,
it is direct, and they can be in both Step Brothers and Boogie Nights and both have like similar like pathos. Even like Step Brothers, I'd say that movie has pathos in it.
100%.
And it's amazing what he's capable of pulling off when seeming like a huge fucking idiot. And he's so good at being such a dumbass. That scene, oh man, where they're in the music studio is maybe this movie's crowning achievement as far as comedy goes.
Oh, like, you got the touch that
yeah,
whole moment.
Yeah. yeah. And like when he's yeah. like he's trying to like rehearse his next song and his voice is absolutely terrible. And then like they're trying to argue their way into getting the tapes and stuff. Like that is
with Robert Downey Sr. of all people.
Oh, I didn't even clock that. Holy shit. That's
yeah,
so funny.
That's Robert Downey Sr. That of like yeah. I literally like saw that and I was like, is that him? And I looked it up, and sure enough, it is Robert Downey. There
you
go.
Fuck, you got
moment.
Don Cheadle's literally named a Buck Swope. So, you know, you might as well shout out the guy. Yeah. There's a, and it's like more absurd moments. This definitely, I don't know, any PTA's movies have a Robert Downey Sr. quality. He seems to be a huge influence. So
he is. Yeah. There's videos online that you can watch of PTA talking about when they did the Eclipse box set up all night with Robert Downey Sr. They got PTA to come in and record some stuff. Yeah. I don't know if it like is still out there or anything, but it's worth a watch. And if have you seen No More Excuses?
I've only seen Putney Swope.
You would love No More Excuses by Robert Downey Sr. That's some big Rocky shit, I think, to be honest with you.
I'm looking it up right now.
I'm looking up No More Excuses, and it's fucking funny. It's fucking hilarious.
I'm on TMDB. I'm fixing taglines, and I'm adding posters.
I'm replacing the licorice pizza poster on Letterboxd through TMDB. Everyone's going to get mad at me, but I have to fucking do it.
I'm putting in the original title for Boogie Nights, according to IMDb, it says Pushing 13. What is that? What is that? Why is it called Pushing 13?
What the hell?
You see that? It says alternate titles or something. But no, there's some bad alternate titles for movies out there in the world anyway. Anyway, moving on. No more excuses.
The Funny Fart. That's an alternate title, right? The Funny Fart.
Yeah, originally it was going to be called The Funny Fart, but I just kind of, my heart went in a different direction.
Yeah, so we called it The Funniest Fart instead, because we wanted everyone to know we don't fuck around here.
Yes, bro. Okay. 4.5 stars from Noah Marger? What? All right.
No More Excuses. Yeah, that's a 4.5 star movie.
But yeah, you have so many actors you can talk about. William H. Macy hasn't even been brought up that much.
That was the one thing I want to bring up before we skirt along here.
Sure, sure.
Is the recurring bit of William H. Macy getting cut.
The humiliation of Little Bill.
It is. That is maybe not on par. One of the most humiliating things I've ever seen in a movie. You've seen Nashville, right? Robert Altman's Nashville.
I have seen Nashville, yeah.
One of the most humiliating things I've ever seen in a movie is when they make her strip in that one scene toward the end of Nashville. That is so hard to watch. That is like, because that's everything in theory that she wants just put on its head and made perverse and bad in like a very exploitative way.
Yeah, definitely.
In this, that's the recurringness of how it's funny when it happens in this movie, because the way that he handles it and the way that like Nina Hartley is just like, yeah, this is happening. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
It's funny. And the way in which it resolves itself and the way in which that is the fulcrum for the rest of the movie.
Yep.
Is so fascinating to me.
It's kind of brilliant. It is. First of all, there's a great clip on YouTube where PTA is doing commentary over this scene and how during one of their first test screenings, I think at the Regency Westwood or one of the theaters in Westwood, it was crushing as a comedy for people. And PTA was like, I'm fucked. It's playing as a joke. People are laughing that he like sees Nina Hartley and then goes to the car and gets the gun. And everyone's like laughing and hooting and hollering apparently. And then as soon as he shoots himself in the head, everyone goes quiet. And then he looks to his producer and they both like basically fist bump and are like, all right.
And they're like, we nailed it.
We crushed it. Yeah, absolutely. But I think because God love William H. Macy. So amazing. He just did Fargo right before this. It's so cool that he's
doing
this movie.
Did he win the Oscar or was he?
I hope so. I fucking hope so. He's so good at that movie in an even scarier way than this. But what's interesting about Little Bill, obviously, you know, if you marry somebody, there's got to be this kind of spiritual understanding and bond between you and your partner of trust and whatnot. But it is such a sad dichotomy because, I mean, one, they're porn star. She's a porn star. So it's like part of her livelihood and she clearly seems to enjoy doing it. There is kind of this world where you could see Little Bill being like, yeah, she's a porn star. She's into having sex. I'm okay with it, whatever, you know, where it's like fine and free-spirited or whatnot. But there is that kind of like, the humiliation of the white man from the 50s and before is just kind of being like noogied until he pulls the gun, basically.
Yeah.
Or and then that is what causes the world to get pushed into the 80s and thusly all of our characters getting like the darkness or whatever, you know? Like it's a beautiful culmination. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying that title card where he shoots himself.
Yeah.
There's a moment of horror from the surrounding people, and then silence. 80s small text.
The smallest white text. Yeah. PT is funny, dude. Amazing. That's fucking funny. Like I love that there was this period of time in his career where he did title cards as these kind of like little witty like chapter breaks and these like kind of like commentaries. It's like his Hitchcock cameo basically, where he's just kind of one more thing, or like, you know, here's another like weird little chapter.
It doesn't take you out of the experience.
Not really,
at all.
No.
In fact, it actually, I think it enmeshes you more.
For sure. I kind of wish he brought that back for Licorice Pizza or something. That probably would have given more credence to the chapters in that film, but we're going to talk about that in 10 episodes.
We'll do something like that. 10 episodes or something like that.
Anyway,
we're not a little pissed off yet.
Not all pissed off yet, but also William H. Macy is great. And yeah, it is funny and sad that this is the tragedy that careens everyone into a changing world, basically. That and also the push to video, obviously.
Push to video and cocaine. Mm. Like, literally, cocaine, the push to video. There's one big scene we didn't talk about. We will talk about it because it's going to come up in my awards. I think you know what it is. If you've seen the movie, I think you know what it is. Rocky, I would like to give you and the listeners some fast facts. Can you handle this?
I'm scared, so I'll be shaking the entire time, but I'm ready. That made me feel better. That's also good. Sorry, shout out Heather Graham. I feel bad that we didn't bring her up.
Heather Graham's great. Apparently this movie affected her casting and other stuff, and she is really, really good in Austin Powers 2.
She's great in general. That's what happens, unfortunately. Which is funny because I feel like at a certain point in like the mid-2000s, maybe, it becomes that if you're not getting naked, you're not getting opportunities.
Yes, 100%.
But it is so crazy that there are things before like 2001, maybe, where like if you're getting naked and having sex on camera, then you are kind of like, you chastised yourself, which is bullshit. But
yeah,
the industry.
Post
9/11,
we wanted to see everyone naked. Pre 9/11, we were like, keep that shit on, please.
I'd rather not, thanks. Anyway.
Hey, excuse me. Can I see your penis? No. Post 9/11. Hey, excuse me. Can I see your penis? Fine.
Okay. I will say,
that's fine with me.
Yeah, dicks in comedies certainly did come around after 9/11. I mean, Apatow brought that in, I guess. But
yeah, they destroyed two of the most phallic buildings in the world.
We had to restore.
We needed
it.
Dicks. We needed to get that shit back on screen.
Noah, that's
brilliant. That was part of the country's healing process, bro.
The cast of SNL turned to Rudy Giuliani on the stage and said, "Rudy, can we start showing penises again?"
He said, "They said, Rudy, give him hell." And then he put his schlong hit Studio 8H's floor. And then Trump comes out and he goes, "That's gonna be so cool for me in 20 years." That's going to be so fucking cool for me, Rudy. Thank you.
He unzips his pants, and then you hear the equivalent of like a rope going down the side of a building before a thud hits the ground.
Doosh. And then Chris Kattan is like freaking out or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
he's exactly. he's doing Mango, but IRL. Holy shit, that guy's dick is huge. Sounds like a rope hitting the concrete.
Okay, right,
here's some fast facts for your ass. You ready for this, dude?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Boogie Nights is based on a mockumentary short film that Anderson wrote and directed while he was still in high school called The Dirk Diggler Story.
Oh.
The short itself was based on a 1981 documentary called Exhausted, John C. Holmes, The Real Story, a documentary about the legendary porn actor John Holmes, whom Dirk Diggler is based on. That's my first fast fact. You kind of mentioned that earlier. Have you seen The Dirk Diggler Story?
I've seen little clips of it. It looks real crunchy. Looks real, real, real amateurish. And I think it's narrated by his father, which is pretty charming. But another actor I know is in it is Rusty Schwimmer, who is great character actress. She was recently in Better Call Saul. But yeah, that's kind of all I know about that one. And I'm pretty sure that the guy who played Dirk Diggler in that is also in Boogie Nights in a smaller role that we might be talking about in a scene that you might bring up later. We'll see. Who knows?
That we might even bring up later?
That we might bring up later? Anyway.
Anderson originally wanted the role of Eddie to be played by Leonardo DiCaprio after seeing The Basketball Diaries. DiCaprio enjoyed the screenplay but had to turn it down because he was going to star in Titanic. He's the one who recommended Mark Wahlberg for the role.
Hell yeah, Leo.
That is so cool. And Joaquin Phoenix was also offered the role of Eddie, but turned it down after concerns of playing a porn star arose.
That's crazy. Wow. Okay. Interesting. I feel like I might have heard that before, but I totally lost that information. Fascinating.
I don't know how I would feel about Joaquin in that role. I don't know if that's good casting, actually, to cast him in this role.
Like young Joaquin. It's, yeah.
Let me say that. Joaquin's one of the greatest to ever do it. So it's not bad casting because he's going to be good in everything. But again, it's hard for me to see anyone but Marky Mark in this role.
The guy who played Dirk Diggler in the short film plays the stereo customer at the beginning of Boogie Nights.
Mm.
You like to hear that.
Bill Murray, Harvey Keitel, Warren Beatty, Albert Brooks, and Sidney Pollack declined or were passed up for the role of Jack Horner, which went to Burt Reynolds.
Damn, Bill
after starring
Murray.
In Hard Eight. I know, that would have been so silly.
A post-Rushmore Bill Murray doing Boogie Nights. Man.
Well, this would have come out before Rushmore.
Oh, wait, Rushmore's like 98, huh? Yeah, you're right.
Rushmore's 98, so this would have been probably the right before if that would have been the thing.
True, yeah. Fascinating.
Fascinating to me. After starring in Hard Eight, Samuel L. Jackson declined the role of Buck Swope. He said, fuck off, went to Don Cheadle instead.
Damn.
And Anderson did not initially consider Heather Graham for Roller Girl because she had never done nudity. Wait, what? Because he had never seen her do nudity in a film. However, Graham's agents called Anderson asking if she could read for the part, which she won. Drew Barrymore and Tatum O'Neal were also up for Roller
Jesus
Girl.
Christ, if Tatum O'Neal was in this movie, holy shit.
I mean, that would be
it's just
actually a little too much for me.
I was going to say, just because Tatum O'Neal has gone through so much. But I mean, also, fuck it. She's an actor, so it's like that's her prerogative. Also, have you heard the Warren Beatty story about this movie?
No, what's on with that?
Warren Beatty got the script and was like, I love this. So you want me to read for Dirk Diggler?
Oh, boy. Come on now, Warren.
Yeah.
Don't say that to me. Say that to me.
That's a PTA anecdote. He's probably told that. I think he's told that on like Jimmy Kimmel and stuff like that. But that's just a funny little thing.
Because of a negative experience with the studio changing this film's title, Paul Thomas Anderson incorporated Boogie Nights into the opening shot of the film as a physical sign.
Yeah. That's good shit.
That's how you do it. I think if you're really trying to make sure your title sticks. Burt Reynolds hated the idea of doing a movie promoting the porn industry and turned the Jack Horner role down 7 times, allegedly.
Jesus.
He also felt like he was selling out and letting down his old fans. After angrily telling PTA the last time he offered the role that he wasn't interested and to leave him alone, Anderson told him that if he could carry that attitude with him into the role, he would be nominated for an Oscar. He subsequently chose to do the film and was nominated for Best Actor in a Supporting Role at that year's Oscars.
God,
so it wasn't wrong.
No, it's also just so funny because there is so much of Jack yelling at Dirk for being a young piece of shit, and I wonder
where that came from.
I know, it's so funny that PTA is kind of just like hiding behind the monitor being like, yeah, be mad at me. Like, use all of that. And
that's ballsy, dude, because the other thing, the elephant in the room, is PTA's 26 when this movie comes out.
Exactly. Yeah, there's like there's a literalism to having like, yeah, Mark Wahlberg and being a young guy, like the Dirk Diggler character as a, you know, ingenue or whatever the term would probably be. Like, yeah, it's so funny that Burt Reynolds actually had animosity toward PTA a little bit and fucking used it. It is like the funniest way. Like, I don't know how aware Burt Reynolds was. I'm hoping it was enough because, yeah, it paid off for him. The motherfucker was great and he deserved his Oscar nomination.
He deserved his Oscar nomination. It probably made him more relevant than he had been in a while.
Revitalized his career, absolutely, yeah.
The prosthetic prop that used for Dirk's penis was kept by Mark Wahlberg as a souvenir from the film. It was made from an easily biodegradable rubber and foam combination, which, according to Mark Wahlberg, has begun to deteriorate. So obviously Mark Wahlberg's checking in on that little prize every so often.
Oh, you got it. I mean, I think he's like slightly denounced this movie, or at least has just been like, I'm Catholic now, so I'm not really proud of that. But, yes. I mean, hey, you can't get rid of that prop. Come on.
It's not to the degree of which Burt Reynolds is like, fuck PTA and fuck my involvement in this. But
yes.
I did read that he was like, hey, you know what? If I was the man who I am now back then, I would not have taken that role.
Exactly.
Basically.
But that's which, also like, you know, you were a better actor back then anyway. I think so.
Back then he was hungry. He wanted to eat. He ate. And now he's like, we're going to make right of center war movies, basically, with Peter Berg.
Yep. Yeah. You know.
It's interesting.
What can you do? What did I watch the other night? Oh, I watched Southland Tales. And I just keep on thinking about how eager The Rock was to make choices before he became a movie star. You know?
Oh, yeah. And it kind of making choices.
And it reminds, and also like listening to ideas, you know, like Richard Kelly probably telling him some crazy shit that he wants him to try.
That he can't even understand. He can't even wrap his head around.
And The Rock being like, okay. And according to Richard Kelly at the Q&A, The Rock would go back to his trailer, study, go out, and then do it perfectly. Like he would just kind of like,
that's awesome.
That's how eager and willing he was. And yeah, it's funny when you catch an actor at that period of time, before they become a huge movie star who then do the easiest shit possible and have like little to no return for it, creatively speaking, at least.
Yeah, it's a business venture for them at that point.
Exactly, where it's like, well, I've done my work, so I'm kind of done doing the action, you know, and enjoying performing. Maybe they still do, who knows? But I mean, I can't think of a Mark Wahlberg movie or a The Rock movie that I've really loved or think they're amazing in and were giving really thoughtful performances in the past 5 years, maybe.
Hey, dude, have you seen my movie Father Stew, Rocky? I think you might like it. I think you might fuck around with Father Stew, Rocky.
Why don't you fuck around and find out with Father Stew?
According to William H. Macy, the scene in which Dirk Diggler wins the Golden Phallus Award was filmed with about 100 extras who had shown up in their own 70s clothes. They weren't told what kind of movie they were in, only that it featured Burt Reynolds. The crowd was told to applaud after Melora Walters announced Diggler as the winner. However, Walters then added the line, I can't wait to have his big cock in my pussy and ass, which was met with stunned silence. About half the extras got up and left set, never to return. Gathering a new group of extras in period clothing caused substantial delays, so when filming finally resumed, PTA carefully explained to the scene to the new crowd so that they knew what they were in for. Ironically, Walters is using a much more subdued line in the finished movie. Wow. The thing that is remarkable to me about that, not only that is a great ad lib by Melora Walters, obviously, yeah, that's really fucking funny. Hilarious. Yeah. When we were making our movies in film school, if that kind of thing happened where that was that big of a delay, our whole production schedules would have been fucked for life.
Yeah, absolutely.
We would have never recovered from something like that happening in terms of being able to finish the movie.
Yeah, that is a severe fuck up in terms of producing and directing in a kind of charming way. But in hindsight, you know, like when you watch any movie, you're like, God, this looks like a nightmare to film. That is a bummer that they like had a incident like that that cost them so much time. But you go on to watch, if you watch a documentary about Making Magnolia, that whole movie is just PTA being like, I'm sorry, I fucked up, we should have done this instead. God damn it. All right, are you guys okay going for another 4 hours? You know, like,
yeah. And it ultimately, like, it probably sucked in the moment, or it probably was one of those things where it was like, you know, like, I'm going to learn from this and not do this kind of shit again.
Sure.
But ultimately, it doesn't derail him from finishing the movie or even like discourage him from experimenting, which I feel like in film school, if that happened, I would have been like, let's just do the most boring possible shit so that I can make the rest of this movie happen and not worry about ruining the rest of my chances of finishing and getting out of here on time.
Absolutely. He clearly, his job does not end until after editing, basically. And I'm glad that he's aware of that because, yeah, his work with his editors are so amazing. I can't wait to talk about his work with Leslie Jones in like two. Well, we already kind of did talk about Punch Drunk Love. So when we get back to the master, anyway,
we're going to talk about Punch Drunk Love actually in a way that I'm going to explain to you after we're done recording here, but it'll actually be a little different than you think.
Ruh-roh.
Or Scooby snack. I'm going to suck my own Scooby snack. And then last two that we got here, Alfred Molina had never heard Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield or Sister Christian by Night Ranger, songs he sings along to in the film. He is from the UK where neither song had been a hit. He spent 3 days playing them repeatedly until he knew them. And Rocky, you serendipitously brought this man up at the very beginning of the episode, so it's very cool that we're going to talk about him right now. Vincent Gallo himself turned down the role of Dirk.
I can't fucking believe this bullshit. I gotta go.
That movie would have been so fucked if he had been Dirk Diggler, dude.
I will say, timeline-wise, it's probably because he wanted to go make Buffalo 66.
Absolutely.
So,
yes.
Good for him. But also,
yeah.
Oh my fucking God, could you imagine? Dude, it's also
I
so great
can't.
Because it's part of the Vincent Gallo, like, meta game where he has a huge dick.
Yes, that's literally it.
Exactly into it. It's so funny. Oh, man. That's so fucked up.
What a world we live in where we could have had a Vincent Gallo starred PTA film that would have broken society. That's now. Nice. Back then, no one would have been like, who cares? What the fuck? But now of days, Twitter.com would be ablaze with that.
Oh, yeah. The effort to cancel PTA would be up and running once again.
Speaking of getting canceled, Rocky, you know what time it is.
Huh?
It's time to cancel ourselves with some awards.
Let's go!
With the categories. Let's go forward. Rocky, what's your favorite scene?
Here's my two runners-up or whatever, or my tie or whatever.
Sure.
First one is Dirk Diggler staring off into space at Alfred Molina's house. That's like part of a bigger scene, obviously. That is one of my favorite pieces of acting and filmmaking that I have ever seen. It feels like something that comes from the master. There's a lot of things in this movie that feel like they're coming from the master, actually. But that feel in particular feels like you are... Look, it could be a recontextualization of an outtake where Mark Wahlberg kind of forgets where he is, or is just like, you know, whatever, like waiting for a line or a direction or something like that. But the way that they utilize him completely zoning out and you catch him remembering where he is and being brought back to like reality... Right. Is incredible to watch, especially because you're in his shoes. You're in a scene in a room where, like, I could die in any second right now. Everything
by any number of things,
by any number of things, anyone can fuck ups, and all of a sudden I'm dead, and it could be over. And he's registering. It's like it's so overwhelming that he just is staring off into space, and that's one of my favorite things in any movie ever. Personally speaking, that's
so cool.
That little moment is so special to me. And then the other one is when Jack goes to jail to talk to the colonel.
That's my favorite scene in the movie too. Actually, that's boy, what I have. That's well, it's tied with something else, but that's one of my favorite scenes. That's tied for my favorite scene in the movie.
Boy, oh boy! The second that Burt Reynolds hangs up the phone, and it's just silence, and you see it just on that actor's face. What the fuck is their name? I feel bad that we didn't.
It's Robert Ridgely.
Robert Ridgely.
It was his final film. He passed away before the film, I think, even came out, to be honest with you. So,
crazy.
And he was a Robert Downey Sr. fave.
Got it.
So that's, obviously, PTA loves Robert Downey Sr. Robert Downey Sr. is in the movie as the record exec or the record guy at the place. Robert Ridgely is the colonel. Robert Ridgely also has a small part in Heart 8.
I didn't realize. Well, there you go. But yeah, the second that Jack hangs up on the colonel and he starts tapping on the window, it is such a cosmic loneliness. It's like this is a person who has lost everyone from his life and is now floating in the abyss and is accounting for crimes that, you know, they may express guilt now, but they are now completely alone and are, you know, like...
Yes.
Someone fucking died. Multiple people have died, obviously, probably in this scenario with this person.
Yes.
You know, and he just never got in trouble for it or whatever. And they're kids and it's fucked up and he might now be copping to it in a way that might be constructive or whatever. But it's too late and people have been hurt and now he is now lost forever in life. And it's so scary to watch on his face with no sound whatsoever. It's like he's in like a fucking pressure lock, you know?
I sometimes want a little jolt in my life, I will YouTube that scene.
That's funny. Wow. Okay, cool.
It is
so
it is harrowing.
Yes.
That scene is harrowing. And they never once say child pornography.
No. No, it's
and
all
you know
pure implication.
Exactly what is at stake in that moment.
Yep.
And Burt Reynolds' reactions and the thought process of him realizing I have to leave this guy in the fucking dust.
He does not exist to me anymore. Yeah.
He is my friend before I walked into this scene. And once I walk out, I don't even know this man.
Persona non grata. Yep.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, dude.
Yeah, great. It's also another scene that, like, you know, hints at something bigger and, you know, more context for the time and for the characters and for everything. And it just, PTA never says it. Like, he never says it. Like you said.
No.
Yeah. And it just it glides over you and you feel terrible.
And on a, what I will say is more, what is more in line with how the film actually is. That's a pretty stark, like, brutalness of that moment is not characteristic of a lot of the rest of the film. But I believe this next scene is, and it's something we actually haven't even talked about at all. The scene where Dirk comes back to Jack and asks for forgiveness, basically. Yeah. It's two shots.
Yeah.
It's him coming back in. Yes. It's a slow push in on back on him and a reverse of them hugging through the door frame as sort of a little way to get out of the scene. And it's beautiful and perfect. Yes. It's beautiful and perfect.
I agree.
And Jack Horner, I don't even know if Jack Horner says anything in the scene. He just gives him a hug and you know, you're welcome back, kid. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful to me.
Yeah. That is also just, I don't know, it kind of going forward to like There'll Be Blood, which has one of the most heartbreaking breakups in my opinion between Daniel Day-Lewis and his son. Like it almost, this almost feels like penance for that in a weird way. Like it's like the forgiveness that you wish you could give but never were able to or something.
Yes.
Like personified on screen. And it's amazing that it like is this gateway into a heavenly good ending sequence that you almost just like, I don't know, I mentioned it earlier, but like you almost feel like it's kind of a cop out, but then it's not, because it's about how PTA loves these characters so much, and it kind of doesn't matter that it's like unrealistic or whatever. Like it's so pure, it's so beautiful, and I agree, that is a great scene. And also, you know, shows how great Mark Wahlberg is in this movie again, you know?
He's great in this movie, and PTA will continually take actors who maybe you wouldn't expect them to be in this position, and they give career best performances. And I will also, I'm going to push back a little bit on what you said. I don't think that this is I don't think this is unrealistic the way that this movie ends.
I don't personally. Think, I don't, you know, I've grown to think like you do. I agree. Probably some instinct I had when I was like a younger filmmaker or something like that. But even then, like, you know, it's not like that doesn't make any sense that it's like a good ending. It is almost like there's so much darkness in this world that I'm so amazed that these people found each other, you know?
Sure.
I think that's more of what it is. It's like, God, this movie shows how much it understands how terrible everything is and how these people are eaten alive and are lost souls if they didn't have each other. And then he just has the artistic integrity. Or, you know, like his own special brand of emotional, you know, awareness or whatever, that he gives us this kind of super bright, colorful ending that is so warm. And I think it's what makes him special, that he makes choices like that, you know.
It is what makes him special, that he decides to do that.
Yeah.
That he makes that choice to say, these people deserve this.
Yes.
And the audience deserves this.
Yes, I fully agree with that. That is what he's saying. And it's so gorgeous. My favorite shot in this movie is Eddie Adams' bedroom. That is a testament to the production design of this film. And also such a beautiful observational moment of filmmaking and storytelling. Like, you get to see, like, the way that we use material to kind of, I mean, you can look into my room through your webcam. Like, every time I enter my room and close the door and I'm like, all right, I'm going to start working on something, or I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch a movie or like whatever I got to do. Like, yeah, you could just pan around my room and see like what shit really means a lot to me and these like movie posters and stuff. And it's something just so boyish and so sweet, especially after like in the movie, I'm pretty sure this happens after Jack and Amber and little Bill go home to their lives, and they're all miserable, basically, for one reason or another. And then you see Eddie Adams, who has so much potential, and he's young, and he has like a future in front of him, and he knows he's going to be a big star and whatever. It's just amazing to see his character told through artifact. Like, it's such a beautiful piece of filmmaking that extends itself to the art design department, production design. And the camera is doing so much of that work, capturing all of it. The music is perfectly picked. It's great. I think it's awesome. And some of PTA's best work, again.
Great pick. Not to parrot what I did last week, but I got to go with the opening shot again. The opening shot tells you so much. It's iconic for a reason.
It's iconic for a reason.
It's amazing. I actually scrolled through on Netflix on my laptop. literally just like on the, what do they call that? When you get a little preview image and you're like scrolling
through the timeline the cursor of the movie, or whatever, yeah.
Through the timeline, just to see if there were any shots themselves,
sure,
that like are like a tableau more so,
yeah,
that had a beauty to them. A close second for me in terms of just aesthetic beauty is the shot where the car pulls up to the strip mall when the guy is about to have Dirk hop in the car, and you have the church in the background, and then yes. like the sky kind of looks painted on a little bit. That's mm-hmm. a very beautiful tableau. But that opening shot, the camera movement, the color, everything about that shot is iconic for a reason, and the fact that it's the first shot of the movie is ballsy.
It's incredible. It's also great because it does show this promise of these characters that you're gonna meet eventually. And then you kind of go through Eddie Adams' life, and he has to break up with his parents and his family, essentially. And it's heartbreaking, and it's overwhelming, and it's so fucked up. And then he goes back to Jack's house, and they kind of do it again in the Oner, where they go through yeah. all the characters and then end up in the pool with the cannonball and stuff. And it's incredible to me that you watch that first scene, you're like, God, this is so great and so thought out and beautiful and exciting. I wonder if the rest of the movie is going to be as good. And then he just fucking does the same thing again, and it's as good, if not better. And I just want to give shout out to that scene because it's also great for similar reasons as you mentioned.
It's a great point.
But that first scene, tied with the music in particular. And after the overture, it is such a beautiful, like, PTA grabs your hand and then flings you into a bounce house. Mm-hmm. And like that, and you're just kind of like in awe of what's happening for the next 10 minutes until, what's it called?
Until some semblance of story starts to actually kick in.
Exactly.
Favorite line?
I kind of mentioned it. So what state am I? I'm in California, Jack. I'm going to try and think of another one that's great to me, too. I mean, another kind of memeable one is my wife's down there with an ass in her cock. And
yeah, that's a great line.
Yeah, that's funny. That's really funny. Oh, I mean, fuck it. It's the entirety of the Scotty J scene after Dirk Diggler leaves when he goes back into his car.
I'm a fucking idiot.
That is another one of the best things PTA has ever done in this movie. And it obviously is down to Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance, but you know, because the line is just, I'm a fucking idiot, but the way that you feel it coming from his gut, from his
yes.
actively bleeding heart is so special to me.
I have a tie between I'm a fucking idiot, Philip Seymour Hoffman doing that in the car, and I look forward to seeing it in action. Jack says you got a great big cock. May I see it? So fucking good.
Yeah.
Just the little pause between Jack says you got a great big cock. May I see it? At the party by the Colonel is so fucking
It's
funny.
Great. And then his like face as he looks at the penis is so stupid.
Yes. If you really wanted to give the full line, he's like, may I see it? And he goes, oh, well, I'm sure you'll be great or something like that. Like, I'm sure you're going to do great out there.
Yeah.
So fucking funny.
It's really good. And also, shout out to Philip Baker Hall, who has a very funny line about butter on his
Butter popcorn. In my ass and lollipops in my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I like simple things, Jack. I like butter in my ass and lollipops in my mouth.
Yep. You got it.
And his character's name is Floyd Gondoli.
Yeah.
Who he mentions in Hard Eight as a guy that he knows.
Very true. Very true.
Which is silly. So silly
at PTA.
Rocky, I gotta ask you. It's so silly at PTA. I give you a big kiss right now. Rocky, what's the best musical moment?
Whoo! I mean, I've talked about all my favorite ones, I think. Like, Jesus Christ. But I think that overture is pretty goddamn gorgeous.
Yep.
Yeah, that's it. That's it for me, dog. Whenever that overture is played, including the beginning and also the ending when it bleeds out from God Only Knows.
I got the same exact answer.
Cool.
Specifically, how it the two moments, like you said, the beginning and at the end, but also just the beginning use of it over Black with the stark transition into Best of My Love by the Emotions. That little moment is hair raising. Yeah. That makes my short hair stand.
Even just thinking about it makes me feel so fucking crazy. But also
makes me feel like I have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, I don't actually have to go to the bathroom, but I have to.
Okay, well, we're almost done. Shout out Sister Christian.
What did you say?
Shout out Sister Christian.
Sister Christian, and I'm sucking dick. And you know I'm gonna suck your dick. It's true. All right, the Luis Guzman Humanitarian Award for the underrated element of the film. Although this is the first appearance of Luis Guzman in a PTA film, I'm not giving mine to Luis Guzman. Rocky, are you giving yours to Luis Guzman?
I'm breaking my medal in half and giving half to Luis Guzman because he's fucking great in this movie. He's very funny. I love when they reveal his new sign and he like immediately clocks that there's a typo and he's just yelling about that. That's one that makes me laugh so goddamn hard. He's so silly.
Very beautiful.
He's so silly to see in PTA movies. He had such a beautiful flavor to his films. But I think, it's Thomas Jane or Melora Walters.
There you go. Those are good. That's a great choice.
Yeah, Thomas Jane is really funny in this movie. There's a shot that zooms in on his hand holding cocaine, and then it freeze frames and then zooms in on the freeze frame for a split second.
Yes.
That is very special. And also Thomas Jane during the Sister Christian scene where he starts laughing to himself and he can't get his lines out and he's muttering his dialogue and stuff. Like, he's a very great scary presence in this movie. And then Melora Walters, who's worked with Don Cheadle in this film, it's like they're children. They're performing their scenes together like they are little kids who are falling in love. And it is really hard to watch because it's so beautiful and so sad, I think.
Yes. But I'd never even pieced it together that was Melora Walters in this movie until this most recent watch.
Right.
And she is equally as good in this movie as she is in next week's movie.
Yeah, I agree.
She just has a bigger playground next week. I brought it up earlier, but I got to give my Luis Guzman Humanitarian Award to Joanne Gleason as Dirk's mom because she is evil in this. She is so mean and so evil in this movie. And you're supposed to hate her.
Yeah.
And you do.
Yeah.
She sucks. She's a bitch in this movie.
It's great because even Eddie Adams' lines are like, why are you doing this? And like you completely empathize with him. She says some things and Eddie catches him like, what are you actually trying to say to me right now? Like, where are you coming from with this? Like, which then sends her hysterics into complete confusion, which is great and scary. Like, I agree. She's
and when
awesome.
When he physically like picks her up and kind of like slams her against the wall, I like want to get up and just like put my fist up in the air. And it is that moment of like, you don't fuck with me.
Yeah.
You don't get to fuck with me because I'm out of here and I'm not taking your shit anymore.
It's like the second. That's like the first of many PTA things where a kid tells a parent, like, you can't be mean to me anymore.
any time that happens in a PTA movie, it's so beautiful.
You love to see kids stand up for themselves. Absolutely. Because all so these.
That gets my.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that gets my Luis Guzman Humanitarian
Award.
I fucking love
that for you, my guy.
Thank you. Okay. All right, now your favorite part of the category is character most likely to say, yup. who do you think that is in this
Ricky
movie?
Ricky J.
Rocky? Yes.
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 Is his name Rocky? Someone's name is Rocky in this movie, actually, if I remember correctly. Or a Rocky is hinted at, I believe. But Ricky
I don't know.
Ricky J's name is Kurt Long John. Jack Wallace. Okay. Oh, this motherfucker's name is Rocky. You see this guy's face and you're like, yup, that's a guy.
You go, yup.
Look at that
guy.
Look at that guy right now and tell me that's not the guy.
Oh, this guy. That I actually always thought that was Seymour Cassell. Yeah. And I'm like, why don't they give him any lines in this movie?
Totally.
That's fucked up. But yes, Jack Wallace. Yeah. Yup.
But I would say the Yup Award goes to Ricky J playing Kurt Long John.
I'm going to give mine to Dirk Diggler.
Yup.
I could see him pulling out a yup.
Yup.
In like a really fucked up way. Sure. Character most likely to say swag or swag 9000. For me, it's Reed
Rothschild. Yeah, exactly. Reed Rothschild
when John C.
creates
Reilly's in
the
movie,
phrase
it's tough.
Swag.
He does. He's sort of like the progenitor of swag
exactly.
in a little bit. Like he's basically saying groovy more or less, but it's swag.
True. That's very true.
And then, of course, character most likely to say yikes, uh-oh.
Jesus Christ. Good Lord. I guess it would be... it'd probably be Melora Walters.
I wrote her down at first, actually. I'm not giving her the award, but I did write her down at first.
Who'd you give it to?
It's a tie for me between Scotty J and Little Bill.
That's true. Scotty J thinks inside his head, yikey, uh-oh, constantly.
But he's too afraid of saying it and maybe being like outwardly thought of as gay. So he just goes, what the fuck? What the fuck? Are you kidding me?
And William H. Macy would say that. He's such a...
He'd be like, yo, my wife's got an ass in her cock. So that's who I give that award to.
Nice.
Rocky, what is the PTA, P-A-R-T, the most PTA part of the whole movie?
It is Jack going back to the kitchen to meet Eddie Adam for the first time.
Jack going, oh, fuck, great fucking because answer, dude.
That scene great answer. Is just from the master. That scene is just two wayward souls being like, I feel like I've known you for a very long time before they go on their crazy journey together. And also, like, I see something in you. There's something very cosmic about it. And it's what is great about PTA's work from that point on, I think.
Great fucking answer.
Thank you.
Damn, I'm jealous that you that's a great fucking
answer. Thank you. Also, the donut store is a great scene, but that's, you know, that's not the most PTA. The most PTA is that other scene.
I have a tie here, and I talked about one of them earlier, and I think that that final scene of Jack walking around the house, checking in on all the people, and then asking Amber Waves, are you ready to go? And he's like, you're the sexiest foxy bitch in the world, or something like that. So, it just lights me up. Just makes me feel, like Mr. Meeseeks from Rick and Morty. Really just lights my dick hair on fire. I love that.
Yeah.
And then what was the other, I forgot to fucking write it down. What the other
scene?
Oh, the fucking scene when they're at Alfred Molina's house.
Yeah.
To me.
Sure. That's a classic.
Yeah.
The fireworks.
Those two are the most.
It's the fireworks of it all. That's just such a special.
And it comes back in the fucking John Peters part in Licorice Pizza. That's the same type of energy to me.
Yeah, definitely. Where it's like all like a sudden threat.
Yes, exactly. All of a sudden, we are fucked for life, and we have to find a way to get out of
this. Yeah. Yep.
So those are my two PTA PTRTs. Rocky, where does this rank on the PTA ranking scale for you?
Currently, it is number 5. I don't doubt that this whole endeavor could possibly rearrange my thing. But I will say my top 5 are all basically... my 1 and 2 are tied, and then my 3 through 5 are tied. So Boogie Nights is currently tied with 2 other movies for, you know, my second favorite kind of PTA movie.
Gotcha. So this currently occupies spot number 5.
Spot number 5 right now.
For me, it's 4 or 5. I think it's 4, number 4 for me right now. But we're more or less ballpark buds, to quote Nick Weiger on that one.
Great.
Sorry for quoting Nick Weiger.
No, I'm glad you did.
And finally, to close out the awards, who, what, which, or when is your, almost said Mercedes Bible player. Can't say that. Not doing some of those anymore. Haha. Who's your MVP? What is your MVP of this?
I mean, in a movie with Scotty J, it's very hard to not say Philip Seymour Hoffman, but it's Don Cheadle.
Wow.
I love Buck Swope as a character, man. His journey is succinct, and every beat that we get of him is simultaneously hilarious and pathetic and incredibly sweet. And I love that this ends with him on top because he deserves it, like all the characters do.
But absolutely.
Yeah, it is so wonderful to watch him do his thing. And also the cowboy thing is so fucking funny because it's inexplicable to everybody. No one has his back on the cowboy thing.
Yeah, they're like, all right, whatever, fuck that.
Yeah.
That's weird. We love this guy. That guy, that's fucking weird. Yeah. We hate that.
He completely bombs a stereo sales pitch using it, and also is unable to really talk about any of the tech of the stereos or whatever. But then it's like, all right, you need a test drive, and then puts on country music. It's really funny.
She's trying to make that his thing.
Yeah.
Like the entire movie, he's trying to make that his thing. And it's not sticking for really anyone other than him. But it's just kind of, there's something kind of courageous and bold about
that. Definitely. That feels very PTA to me also, as far as characters go. Just people like the dichotomy of how they feel about themselves versus how the world feels about them is kind of this tragic thing. But I just love Don Cheadle's embodiment of this character. He is the heart of this movie somehow for me.
I'm going to be a little more broad with my MVP award. I'm just going to give it to the ensemble. Like I said,
Of course.
Just as a whole, this is one of
most
stacked.
You cheated.
I'm a cheater. I'm a big piece of fucking shit. I cheated. I'm not going to be elected to the Podcasting Hall of Fame because I use performance enhancing drugs to podcast with you right now. I wasn't even being subtle about it. I'm being very forthright about it. But this is one of the most stacked casts ever.
Yes.
Ever. Like, amazing that this is an assemblage of talent on screen. I almost just gave the award to PTA in general, which I feel like is kind of a cop-out a little bit, to be honest with you. But I'm going to give it to the ensemble and just the fact that all these people are on screen. Not always all together, but they're all on screen over the course of the 2 hours and 35 minutes that we are rolling on them. And it's amazing. It's like the fact that that even exists is amazing to me.
I agree with that. But also, if you wanted to give PTA an MVP award, this would probably be it, because this is...
Yeah.
Like, this is the
this
grand...
This is coming out party.
This is the grand premiere. This is him kicking open the doors and everyone just kind of, like, having to put sunglasses on.
Basically. Yeah. That was my thinking about it, where I'm like, he does Heart 8. Not a lot of people see it because Reicher fucked him, and also it's not quite exactly what we'd come to know PTA as.
For sure.
And then this is his, like... The Heart 8's his true debut, but this is what I think a lot of people think of as his first real movie.
Sure.
You know?
Definitely.
And so this is him coming out of the gates and being like, this is who I am. So that's why I thought about it, but this is also the PTA podcast, so I don't know if I can really justify giving him the MVP award,
sure.
I'll give it to the ensemble, but also, yes, in a spiritual way, Paul Thomas Anderson does win my MVP award. Rocky, those were the categories. Those are the awards. I want to play a very quick game with you, if you would be so kind.
Okay.
I'm going to borrow from the boys down in Nashville, from the YKS boys. I'm going to borrow a format. Rocky, this movie that we talked about today, Boogie Nights. It's about pornography. It's about the porn industry in the changing of the guard in the 70s and 80s. And something that pornos were very famous for were their porn parodies of other movies.
Yes, bro. Absolutely.
So we're gonna play a quick game of real or fake. I have 10 porn parody titles.
Okay.
And you're gonna guess if they're real or if I made that shit up.
I like it. Let's go.
I like it. I like it a lot. I like it a lot. What is that from?
It's Dumb and Dumber.
It is from Dumb and Dumber. That's right. For some reason, I thought it was from Master of Disguise, Pistachio.
Definitely
Disguise.
In the right realm, but it is for sure a Dumb and Dumber thing.
Rocky.
Huh?
Speaking of Dumb and Dumber.
All right.
Ass Ventura, crack detective, real or fake?
Fake.
Real. That one's real. That one's real.
Damn it.
Unfortunately, that one is real.
Okay.
Moving on. The Da Vinci Load. Real or fake?
Real.
Correct. That one's real.
Wow. Yep, I'm gonna look these up. I'm gonna open up some tabs.
Hey, do that on your own time, brother. Come on now. You can jack off on your own time. You don't need everyone else to be hearing about that.
Bro, I've been doing it. All right, go ahead.
I've been jacking off. I actually have been.
I'm Ben jacking off.
I have been jacking off during this. Number three, In Rearendance Day.
Real.
Yep, damn. That one's real too. Two for three. Remember the Tight Ones.
Oh, God. Come on now. How does that even work? Unless it's like a, I mean, that's fine if it's gay. I mean, that'd be cool. That one's fake.
That one is unfortunately real as well. That's according awesome. To my according to my research. Okay. Two for four. In Diana Jones and the Temple of Poon.
I just want that one to be real.
And you are correct. It's real as well. That was that 3 for 5. I think
3 for 5. Yeah.
All right. Topped Gun, Mav Dick.
Real.
That one's fake. I made that one up. Fuck you.
There you go.
Fuck your fucking ass.
I was about to say, this one's probably not real because it's a bad title. Unlike
Lawrence of My Labia.
God, that's like a joke porn parody title, though. I'm going to say that's real.
You are correct. That one is real. That one's real.
What's up?
All right. Reservoir Hogs.
Wow. Fake.
Yep, that one's fake. Cool. I made that one up.
I wish that one existed.
Fuck Club.
Real.
Fake, made that one up.
Damn.
Maybe that's real, but I did make that one up off the top of my head. But we're going to say fake. And then closing us out, Rocky, Poon 1001, A Cock Odyssey.
Real.
That one's fake. I made that one up, you motherfucker.
All right.
If you were keeping score at home, let me know, because I was not keeping score. Rocky, thank you so much for joining me on another edition of My Favorite Podcast, where we talked about Boogie Nights. The floor is yours. What are your plugs?
Every Monday and Thursday, please check out Everything Now Show on twitch.tv/everythingnowshow. 8 p.m. Pacific, Mondays and Thursdays. We're an interactive comedy show, kind of like Blue's Clues for adults, where you hang out with a character and then some performers and improvisers come on as characters in the world on green screen and goof around and ask for your help. And you can affect the show by paying for sound alerts or voting in polls and that kind of stuff. It's a silly, silly time. And yeah, I love doing it. Also, follow me on Letterboxd at R-O-N-C-K-Y, Ronky. I'm on Twitter at Rocky Pajarito, and then I'm on Instagram as The Lawn Wrangler. That's it.
Thank you. Great plugs.
Thanks, bro.
As far as my plugs go, I want to thank everyone who came out to the Cat's Crawl show on August 26th, saw my stand-up debut. I had a blast. Thank you so much for everyone who came out there. If you're listening to this and you produce a comedy show, a stand-up show, or any, I guess really anything, but if, I mean, even if it's stand-up, whatever, if you produce a comedy show in LA, please let me do it.
Speaking of, first of all, yes, I agree with that. And I also forgot that on September 7th at the PAC Theater at 10:30 p.m., I'll be performing as part of Go Sketch Yourself. I'm going to be doing a routine that I've done before once.
Woo!
And had fun doing, and I'll be doing it again, and hopefully I'll film it so people can watch it on the Patreon. Just kidding.
And if I'm not in Las Vegas with my dad, I'll be there too.
Shouts out
to Vegas with my dad. Otherwise, you can follow this show on Twitter and Instagram at MyFaithPod on both Twitter and Instagram, and then you can follow me on Twitter at Noah Marger and Instagram @Noah_Marger on Instagram. I think that's basically it.
I think so.
Rocky?
Can't think of anything else.
Once again, thank you so much. Next week, please join us for our discussion of
Magnolia. Shortcuts. Oh, shit.
Oh, that's so silly. Oh, that's so silly. Now we're going to play the outro. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah.